For several years now, one of my New Year's resolutions has been to fish more. I have said as much on this program. As a kid, I was a fishing fool, and on the water somewhere with every free moment I had. Pond, stream, river, and lake, and there were plenty of each to choose from across central Kansas. I continued to fish heavily like that through my teens and college years, and even through my 20s and my first stint in Alaska. Then, somewhere in my early 30s, I started to slow down. It was still fun, but I no longer made as much of an effort. Somewhere in my 40s, it slowed to a crawl, even as my desire to hunt grew like a well-fed teenage boy. And then, finally, in recent years, I've been self-aware of how far I've fallen with regards to sport fishing, and I add resolutions in an attempt to turn the ship around. Last year, it worked. I fished more than I have in a long time. My plan is to try and at least maintain what I did last year, this year. That said, wanting to fish more, there are types of fishing I haven't done and, if I'm being honest, really don't have any desire to do, though they are clearly wildly popular with other area anglers. One of those has been happening a lot of late. I'm talking about fishing for smelt. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Visitor Services Manager for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Smelts are a family of small fish found across a lot of the northern parts of our continent, as well as Asia and Europe. The operative term here is small. I don't fish for them myself, because they're small and because I don't eat them. I recognize two things about sharing that with everyone. First, I'm a bit of a hypocrite on the size thing. I do fish for, or I used to anyway, and love fishing for bluegill, and they are a small fish. The difference is, I love to eat bluegill. The other thing is, like bluegill, I know smelt can be caught in prodigious numbers, which, for those who do like to eat them, make them a valued target. So while my desire to go smelt fishing is non-existent, I do recognize that they are a very popular target for area anglers. And if you listen to this show with any regularity, you probably know what's coming next. Anything to get folks outside. If that's smelt fishing, then I am totally pulling for you. There are a number of types of smelt found in Alaska. Around our part of the state, that number is 3. Ulican, called hooligan, rainbow smelt, and pond smelt. Again, I know they're very popular, locally, and it's funny to me that such a small fish has such clout from an area that is known globally for its big fish, such as our salmon. Our smelt, typically none of them ever exceeds 10 or 12 inches in length. All are slender in shape and predominantly silver on the sides, with greenish or bluish backs. In fact, they look somewhat like an elongated salmonid, and they do have an adipose fin. Of the 3, pond smelt can be told from the other 2 because they have brush-like teeth on their tongue. Otherwise, they look generally like the other 2, with a torpedo sort of body shape, large dorsal fin, fleshy adipose fin, and a forked tail. Coloration is brownish to olive green. The belly is silvery white, and the head and cheeks, if you look close, are speckled. Around Alaska, they are found in coastal waters of the southern parts of the state. They spawn in June in shallow waters with a lot of cover. Of our Area 3, they are a smaller sort, with 7 or 8 inches being a large one. They feed on zooplankton, insects and algae, and in turn they are prey for virtually anything larger. They are anadromous, meaning a part of their life is spent in freshwater, and a part is spent in the ocean. Both rainbow smelt and ulican are anadromous too, and spend a good portion of their lives living in nearshore saltwater areas and around the tidal portions of rivers. I have had the opportunity to see rainbow smelt in just plain silly stupid numbers along the shores of Nunavachik Bay. Strong winds can come up and blow them along shore, near a stream that empties into the bay during the month of May, as they're staging to migrate and spawn. It's very impressive to see, and provides predators with a chance at an easy meal. When the water temperatures are optimal, at that time of year, they swim up rivers to spawn, though they typically don't go very far. Once they get where they're going, the females can lay tens of thousands of eggs. The fertilized eggs become sticky shortly after exposure to water and eventually settle to the bottom of the river and adhere to rocks. When the egg hits a rock, the outer covering breaks free and somewhat turns inside out, forming a stalk for the egg to rest on. This allows the eggs to get plenty of oxygen from the water during their development. Smelt enjoy a rich history as a subsistence species and continue to be a wildly popular fish for personal consumption today. Methods of preservation or preparation vary greatly from eating them fresh to making dry fish to rolling them in batter and frying them. Methods of capture vary too. Many people prefer to use dip nets, gill nets, or seines. Still others like to fish for them through the ice using monofilament fishing line. I know a bunch of folks who have been doing that in recent weeks on area rivers. I was first introduced to smelt by a good friend of mine over near Lake Iliamna. Hey, Michael Trifon. He liked to fish for them through the ice using a hook and line, as many around here do as well. Candlefish, he called them at the time, though I knew nothing about them at all. I now know that's just another name for eulachin, though I can't say for certain what type of smelt they actually were. All I remember is that he would get really excited about fishing for them, and there was never such a thing as too many, a mindset that I'm sure many around our area still have today. And I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention the fabled smelt of the Togiak River, which are the Goliaths of the smelt world. For whatever reason, the smelt found on the Togiak are discernibly bigger, on average, than those found in other area locations. I have two other brief mentions of topics before finishing today. First, 3 weeks ago, I talked about the shortage of supplies related to firearms. Firearms themselves, ammunition, and ammunition components. I mentioned at the end that maybe that came across as one big nag or gripe. Perhaps it reeked of gloom and doom. That wasn't really the purpose, but given the state of things, it's easy enough to see how it maybe went in that direction. Well, one listener, Mr. Mark Birch with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, emailed me with an excellent suggestion regarding the state of things right now with firearms and ammunition. Let me share Mark's words, paraphrased ever so slightly, for reading on the air. Now might be a good time to encourage folks to safely practice dry firing their rifles. The first thing to emphasize is to unload and move to a room where there is no ammunition. Check and recheck to make sure the firearm and any source of ammunition, such as magazines, are empty. Point at something that will stop a bullet if possible. Gun safes, rock or brick fireplaces, or a freezer full of meat, if you are so fortunate, are potential examples. At least point in a direction that does not include a neighbor's house. You can practice moving from walking or standing to hunting positions like kneeling, sitting, or even prone, if you are likely to be hunting in alpine or relatively dry tundra. A lot of people discount prone as a hunting position, but I have been on a number of hunting trips where caribou were taken from prone positions. Sitting and kneeling are often possible. Practicing standing is also beneficial. Folks may want to practice use of a hasty sling in any of these positions. When finished practicing, say something out loud to the effect of, "I am done, no more practice." Then you can put the firearm away. It's important to make this break. Tragic mishaps often happen when people reload and practice one more time. This practice is helpful as holding exercises without even having to pull the trigger. Dry firing to improve trigger control and follow-through also are very helpful. Even when there is no ammunition shortage, mixing dry fire practice in with live fire is often more effective than live fire practice alone. Mark's advice is excellent. There is a great deal of benefit to practicing through dry firing, though it should absolutely be done with safety as a priority. Handling your gun breeds familiarity with it, and that can only be a good thing, which pays dividends while you're at the range or in the field. Some types of firearms can be susceptible to damage to the firing pin with repeated firings. If that's a concern, consider using dummy rounds. They don't cost much and are available for most common calibers. Dry firing can also be a great tool for prepping for a specific hunting style. In a couple of months, I'll be on a hunt that utilizes shooting sticks, a method I've not used before. In preparation for that, I've been practicing at home, and hope to transfer that practice to the range in the near future. One last thing I'd mention. Today is the opening day for the Alaska Subsistence spring-summer migratory bird season, which will soon be a welcome thing for many area hunters. I say soon because it's not like the skies are darkened with returning birds just yet. That's likely a few weeks down the line. Even so, it's a good thing to know that season is open, and I would mention, regulation books are already out there. I'll likely spend an episode on just this topic in the coming weeks. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.